Well, to this, humanity is waging war on nature. This is suicidal. Nature always strikes back, and doing so with force and with fury. The UN Secretary Antonio Guterres, Secretary General Antonio Guterres, did not mince his words. He went on to list a litany of human-inflicted wounds, a million species at risk of extinction, dying coral reefs, air pollution killing 9 million a year, reports The Guardian's environment correspondent Fiona Harvey. With us is Associate Professor Ralph Chapman, who is at the School of Geography, Environmental and Earth Science at Victoria University of Wellington. Ralph, kia ora.
Kia ora, Wallace, how are you?
I'm very well. You would not get much starker than those words. Actually, quite an extraordinary speech, really. I mean, putting aside all the politeness and all diplomacy, but I guess, is this what is now needed?
I think it is, really, frankly. And, you know, we had the climate emergency declared in New Zealand yesterday in Parliament. And, you know, we've got a string of warnings from eminent people like Guterres over the last few years, and they've been ramping up because the combination of things like biodiversity loss and climate change has become more and more worrying, and people like Attenborough have sort of mixed into that call and really said the collapse of civilization is on the horizon. And I'm beginning to think, and I've been working on these issues for 30 years, but I'm beginning to think with the way the climate is going at the moment that, human action is just not serious enough in dealing with the issues. So, you can't discount those. It sounds very melodramatic, but, I don't think we can discount those warnings. And, if you think back to that special report, the IPCC, the world's climate scientist body, did in 2018, they said, look, we've got a decade to cut our emissions in half globally, or we're going to shoot way past this 1.5 degree warming limit. It's a sort of threshold, really. And once you go beyond 1.5 and, you're up around 2 or more degrees of warming, then all bets are off. We've got just so many possible feedback systems that can kick in at that point. And a lot of those are very scary, like the release of, methane from the tundra and so on. So, it all adds up to quite a bleak picture. And I was reminded, I went to a Peter Barrett symposium about a week ago. He's one of our eminent climatologists and Antarctic scientists and geologists by training. And getting on for 20 years ago, he said, look, if we end up with 3 degrees of warming, that'll be the collapse of civilization. And that's where we're heading. Did you realize that the pledges of different governments around the Paris Agreement add up to about 3 degrees of warming? So that's what governments have pledged to take us to.
Right. Well, it's funny, you compare it to, another sort of emergency, of course, Rafe, the pandemic, and it seems that we have a vaccine for that. We don't know how it'll pan out, but it's almost like we need some sort of vaccine for climate change. I mean, it just seems so insurmountable, a problem of enormous proportions. It can feel a little daunting to the ordinary person.
Yes, that's very true, and yet it's not fundamentally, something that we have to put up with. It's not inevitable, and I think there is hope.
Right.
But it won't come down to a simple fix like a vaccine. I mean, you can't take most of the world's cars off the road with a vaccine. And that's the sort of measure. It's interesting to see, for example, in the UK, they've recently said by 2030 there'll be no new petrol and diesel cars for sale. That's 9 years away. That's pretty radical stuff. And that's Boris Johnson, a Conservative Prime Minister, announcing that. And, frankly, that's the sort of action that all developed countries should be taking now.
All right, let's go to our panellist, Zina. What do you have a question for Rafe?
A comment, really.
Yeah.
I grew up in Fiji, like I was telling you earlier, and the impact of climate change is very real for the people there. It's not a hypothetical anymore. So strong words are great and pledges are good, but they need to be backed by action, right? And you mentioned the pandemic. I mean, with all the recovery efforts around COVID-19, we have actually got an opportunity to build back better And that can drive some change. We also, I mean, you'd like to think that people do things because it's the right thing to do, but sometimes they need financial incentives to do it. And we're starting to see that, you know, investors are realizing that the sooner they move to a green and digital economy, the better it is for them and their assets as well as for their clients. So those are some things that we're starting to see. And I think also the younger generation now is less accepting of this and more vocal about it.
Rafe?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I think, you know, Jacinda Ardern and her government is, you know, they're across the issue. And, you know, they have done certain things already, you know, some of which are controversial, like banning new offshore oil and gas exploration. But they've also done a number of things. You know, they've been supporting agricultural research and, you know, to try and reduce methane and nitrous oxide. They're building houses in more compact urban form and so on. And, you know, they're trying to decarbonize the public transport fleet. Well, a bunch of things. But my concern is that even they will recognize that that's not enough and that there has to be a cranking up of that policy package, you know, to do things like rethink transport in a big way in the city. So, you know, we don't just go for more EVs and electric vehicles and invest, you know, we have to do things like investing in e-bikes and e-buses and cycle lanes and better footpaths and more compact housing development. And there's a bunch of connected things that will transform the way we get around our cities. And that's what's needed.
Chris Wikaida.
Do we, I was just on that note, is there a risk that we affect society and those who are already the most vulnerable? Because things like EVs are expensive. Some of the things we're going to do to curb warming are going to be expensive. How do we protect those who already are struggling to get by?
Well, you know, pick up on that EVs one. They are costly, and that's the point I'm making in a way that, you know, and this has come out in Britain. People have said, look, you know, banning petrol and diesel vehicles from 2030 is all very well, but what about poor people who have to get around, especially outside the city? And, you know, in the city, there are good alternative solutions, and they include things like e-buses and e-bikes and, you know, scooters and so on, and building more compact parts of cities. So, you know, the apartments and townhouses that are more centrally located, so you don't need to take a car everywhere. And also more working from home will help. So, you know, there's a series of connected, integrated, if you like, solutions that, you know, provide a way through. And maybe green hydrogen for, you know, people on the outskirts of cities or, you know, people who have to move around the countryside and so on, farmers and so on. So, there are solutions. And I think the government is probably very conscious of the, you know, the inequality aspect of it all and, you know, trying to bring people along at the same time. But, you know, it shouldn't stop us trying to make those radical shifts, those transformations.
Right. Antonio Guterres said, look, unless the world cuts fossil fuel production by 6% every year between now and 2030, things will get much worse, much worse, he said, quoting him. In the 30 years you've been looking at this issue, do you remain an optimist, or do you actually go, I'm not so sure we can do it?
Is that better? Is that sound coming through now?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. 30 years, yes, I've been working on it for 30 years. You know, I have got more pessimistic, but I'm not out of hope. I think we still do have a possible future scenario pathway forward. But it does now, because we've left action so late, it does involve more radical transformative action right across the board, not just, you know, farmers trying to reduce methane and nitrous oxide, but also people in cities transforming their transport system and rebuilding the shape of their cities and so on.
Mm.
Yeah, so that's, you know, quite radical stuff, really. And we've got to leave space in the atmosphere for those developing cities in Asia and so on. So, it's quite a tricky combination.
Yes, indeed, isn't it? Great to have you on the program again. Associate Professor Rafe Chapman there from the School of Geography, Environmental and Earth Sciences, Victoria University of Wellington. Big, big issue. Zina, seemingly untractable, but I guess, hey, if we all do our bit over time... What do you reckon?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't want to trivialise it because it is a big issue and a very important issue. But if you think about how we adapted to COVID and the way we changed how we work and how we live and everything, what that just goes to show is that, you know, when push comes to shove and we have to change our behaviour.
Fair point.
We can do it.
Chris, how do you convince people that the scale is similar or the same so that they respond in the same way? You know, COVID was something that might kill you. The climate change stuff, people don't make the same connection in their minds.
Yeah, and that's something that we really need to do to enable people to see the scale of devastation that's on its way, you know, for the world economy and for human life.
And as you say, people back home in Fiji, they're really living it, aren't they?
Yeah. Mm. You know, oceans, temperatures going up, sea level rising.